Today on Against the Grain.
People who had post-viral conditions that were unverifiable were perceived as kind of fakes and not really sick in medicine. And I think that stigma and that kind of narrative has profoundly impacted medical education and how many clinicians perceive and understand this condition.
As influenza cases reach a 25-year high, a look at the complicated politics of long-lasting post-viral conditions. Medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall considers how the medical establishment has frequently ignored chronic but often invisible illnesses like long COVID and long flu, chronic fatigue syndrome, and Lyme disease. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How does the medical establishment understand conditions that doctors cannot easily measure or diagnose with an MRI or a blood test? And how do long-standing assumptions about women and people of color shape how certain conditions are discounted or chalked up to mental distress? Emily Mendenhall is professor at Georgetown University and the author of Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID, which takes an anthropological look at the ways researchers and clinicians have regarded complex chronic illnesses, many of them post-viral in nature. Emily, how did the COVID pandemic, and of course long COVID, shift the way that those in medicine, as well as the wider public, thought about and think about long-term chronic illnesses, including those triggered by viruses?
The COVID pandemic was a moment, like the great influenza a century before, where the virus was so visibly affecting people in the acute stage that there was a global understanding of affliction. And so when the post-viral condition lingered and afflicted people in such deep ways, there was a depth of knowing and understanding what the acute infection was and how it affected people. So it transformed how people started thinking about the chronicness of infection and what it looks like as it lingers.
How did the medical establishment tend to view such infections beforehand and their post-viral effects? I mean, COVID, of course, was not the first illness to really have, in some people, pretty profound, long-lasting chronic effects. The flu, the influenza virus being another one. What was the sort of reigning notions, if you were to characterize it, within the medical establishment up until that point?
One of the tenets of biomedicine is on identification and verification of a health condition. And one of the challenges of something like long COVID or myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, another disease category, or chronic Lyme, another post-viral infection-associated condition, one of the challenges is these are not verifiable conditions. And in biomedicine, it's really difficult to verify and define where symptoms are coming from and identify and associate these diagnoses with these infections. So for so long, there's earlier work, even in neurology, on hysteria, neurasthenia, these older terms and frames of how post-viral or unverifiable conditions were framed and named and largely feminized in medicine. And over time, these names and illness categories have shifted and transformed with modernity and how the culture of medicine has framed unverifiable conditions. And even to this day, some of the ways in which conditions were talked about in the mid-1800s through the early 1900s have been really dismissive and psychologizing these conditions and dismissing the possible biological verifiability of them. And I know that's maybe a confusing way to frame it, but for a long time, women just weren't believed, or people with these lingering conditions were dismissed for not having conditions that the doctors could see or verify or realize in a real way. So they were dismissed and sent home. Or in the 1800s, there's lots of novels and reflections on people with a condition called neurasthenia, which was in many ways characterized how long COVID or a post-viral condition is today. And one of the cures was the rest cure. And now this was a highly classed condition. So it was identified largely with white women of the upper class. And their cure was to sit alone in a room and be isolated and let go of painting and thinking and really interacting with the world to recover. So many of these conditions were just incredibly sexist and dismissive. And partly because embedded in this kind of legacy of medicine that has dismissed women's health and women's kind of physiological needs for so long.
Right. And that notion of a sort of subset of malaise, I guess we could call it, that especially afflicts privileged women remains with us to this day. And I should say, of course, there are many people who also struggle with these illnesses who are not privileged or white women, but there does seem to be this association. And so I wondered if you could talk a bit more about the notion of hysteria itself and how even the word is tied to women's bodies.
When we think about medical diagnoses, these are culturally constructed. Biomedicine itself is a culture, meaning it's a way of thinking and a way of naming and a way of understanding the body and the world. So when we think of hysteria, this was a culturally constructed condition that was defined by the times when it emerged. And it changed with time as ways of knowing and other people were infected or presented with these experiences and these conditions, or if a biological identification was named. Like people with multiple sclerosis, MS, for years were diagnosed with hysteria until they were able to clearly identify plaques in the brain, which was then called MS and understood to be that way. So there's been very many conditions that have been put in this illness category for years. But, you know, really dealing with how these conditions have shifted over time have presented with a depth of knowing of what these conditions do in the body and in the cultural space. So if we think about long COVID, there's this woman, Chimea Sweeney, who is leading this Black women's long COVID organizing, because people for years who don't fit this kind of white, middle, upper class, normative disease category have experienced conditions, post-viral conditions. And she's leading this. She's doing a documentary. She's doing a bunch of advocacy about recognizing what the condition does in people's lives. And so one of the things that she has led as an activist and what other clinicians who are working in long COVID and others have really led to think about is what does it mean to live with a post-viral condition and have these symptoms in a medical space that doesn't recognize your suffering in the way, because you have this very unverifiable condition. And one of the ways that I've come to think about it, and I have long worked with specifically women living with chronic illness. When I was a doctoral student, I worked at the old Cook County Hospital for 5 years with Mexican women seeking care living with diabetes. And what I learned there and how that, and you know, I've worked in India and South Africa and Kenya around the world with largely women, but low-income people living with diabetes and facing the social realities in their lives with this chronic illness. I learned that when you have a diabetes diagnosis, which is a very recognizable and treatable and widespread illness that people experience, although this illness means different things in different places because culture and society, as well as how a health system is built and structured, influences how people think about their diagnosis and live with an illness. But what's interesting is that I found that people who don't have great access to healthcare or health insurance use a diagnostic illness to get care for all of the other wraparound conditions that they're having. But, you know, in Western context, in Western biomedicine, we have this real patient blaming organization within clinical structures. So if you have a diabetes diagnostic and you're not able to keep your weight down or you're not able to keep your insulin regulated, there's often a patient blaming. So you're there, you know, the clinician is like, are you eating right? Are you exercising? Are you taking your medications? Now, there's this whole other element that many dietary recommendations, especially for people who are not white and are living in the United States and are not wealthy, that don't really make sense for patients who actually need to adapt their diets and their ways of living with chronic illness in ways that, you know, nurture them and their culture and their families. But the other element that I really found through this study, and I was also editing this other book at the time called Savoring Care, Flourishing with Diabetes Across Cultures. And I had a colleague who sent me this essay on this woman from Guatemala who had diabetes, but she so clearly had myalgic encephalomyelitis chronic fatigue syndrome, which I'll call from here on out ME/CFS, which is a common illness construct that was created in Western biomedicine to define what another kind of variation of long COVID, but other viral conditions like the different variations of flu or other infections, where there is this post viral kind of disability. And, you know, I came to really realize that so many people I've worked with around the world who had these kind of disabling conditions that wouldn't go away, that clinicians were like, you're not following the rules, you're not following the regulations that I have laid out for you to deal with your diabetes. Well, there's this deeper post-viral reality that people are living in their bodies that isn't going to be rectified by these very narrow implications. And throughout my whole career, I've been really interested in what these synergistic effects of different infections or biological vulnerabilities do to affect people's lives. So, you know, that's actually been a really, really interesting thing for me to think about, is how do these post-viral conditions live in our lives and kind of in the background of medicine, without diagnostics and without clinicians really being trained to take them seriously and to recognize what these symptoms are and what they do. So it causes a lot of stress for patients who are trying to manage their diagnosed conditions while experiencing these undiagnosed and unverifiable conditions.
Well, I'd like to return to how you see these conditions broadly and the notion of thresholds. But I wanted to ask you if what you've just described, how patients that you have seen who are being treated for something like diabetes, which is verifiable, i.e. there are tests that can be done on this patient and that indicate that, you know, she has diabetes, that many people, many patients find themselves with actually a whole cluster of ailments, but that they might just get coverage or recognition from the medical system that something's wrong for that one infirmity that is verifiable. And I wanted to ask you, how much of that is connected to our for-profit medical system, where if you don't have a diagnosis that is verifiable, then if you're lucky enough to have insurance, that your insurance might not cover you?
Our healthcare system is so broken. So much of what people can access is framed around these diagnostics. And to get care, you need these diagnostics to be verified by, you know, for every condition, a series of tests and verifiability so you can get medical coverage. For chronic Lyme, for example, there's this amazing book called Divided Bodies by Abigail Dumas that talks about how actually, in many cases, insurance companies will not accept or recognize a chronic Lyme diagnosis. And so they won't permit any sort of care if someone is diagnosed with that condition. And this is in part because these conditions are so finicky. There's not a clear diagnosis and treatment. In fact, it's like this intense unraveling of the body and the vulnerabilities of what infections do, because, you know, conditions move through the bodies and through all of your systems. So thinking about diagnostics as a way to get care, that is something I really saw with the diabetes diagnoses, especially at Cook County so many years ago, that, you know, what people really need is an introduction to the medical system so that they can even access the care they direly need, even if they're not going to get a diagnosis for all the other conditions. Once they have one diagnosis, specifically a recognizable diagnosis, then they can get care for all the other conditions. So if you have a diabetes diagnosis and you have conditions, you have ME/CFS, for example, or you have long COVID, through that diabetes diagnostic, you can get the care that you need. This has been a long-standing issue in medicine in general, especially in for-profit health systems that really don't put people first, they put profits first. So one of the things that's really tricky with long COVID, and all of these other health conditions that are variations, I talk in the book a lot about septad, which is a patient. Well, I don't t talk about septad a lot in the book, but I reference and kind of speak around it because patients often speak about having these conditions, and there's so many overlapping conditions that kind of move together in a Venn diagram. There's, seven cascades of conditions that people experience. So if you have one condition, it's very likely that your body slowly develops another one. Like mast cell activation syndrome is very, very common among most patients with ME/CFS and long COVID. And thinking of the overlap of how these conditions come together and how they ebb and flow and move in the body, it's really the kind of opposite of what biomedicine does because, there are so many clinicians in my family, for example, or clinicians from nurse practitioners to general practitioners to internists who really try to take time to really figure out and get to the, the pinpoint of what's really causing someone's prolonged chronicity or chronic suffering. But our health system is structured in such a way, in part because it's profit-oriented, in a way that makes physicians not have the time and the depth of time or the structure itself to really deeply care for these patients, in part because there are so many complicated symptoms that patients have to go to see a specialist for. So Elba Azola, she's a physician at Johns Hopkins University, and I have been, we have a think piece coming out in a new journal that I've just launched called Science Politics that talks about the challenge of long COVID clinics. So long COVID clinics are really incredible. They've emerged to help patients get the care that they need. But what we argue is that they're set up wrong. And this is a kind of reflection of the entire American medical system itself. It's so disjointed and disorganized that when you go to a COVID clinic, you're going to see a family doctor. But with the COVID clinic itself is it functions as a switchboard. So what it does is it says, okay, you have this symptom. You have to go to this doctor. You have to go to this doctor. You have to go to this, and I'm going to help you get all your referrals. But for someone with an energy limiting condition who really suffers in the morning, I mean, who struggles like on one day, taking a shower can be the most difficult task that you can do that day. And that it will actually unravel the energy that you have to get through the rest of the day. So, going to all of these doctor's appointments can really be a detriment for you actually engaging with your family, with your children, caring for the people you love, and also just engaging in everyday activities. So, long COVID clinics cannot be switchboards. And although it's great to have a step towards even imagining having a long COVID clinic, what we argue is that you need to have a clinic where you go for, let's say, an hour, and all of the specialists are working on a team to give you that concerted attention and diagnosis or recommendation of how to come to understanding your collection of conditions that you have that you move through the world with. And only through this kind of concerted, focused attention can people with these really complex conditions get well. And one thing that I frame in the book, and I talk about this woman, Tam, her story. What I've come to know, and in graduate school, I was studying psychophysiology and studying with a biological anthropologist, Tom McDade, who was really focused on how we understand the multiple levels and layering of stress and how stress builds up in the body and then tips you over. There's a great book called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers by Robert Sapolsky that really focuses on this idea of allostatic load or on the idea that, if you have two stressors, you can carry them in your body, in your mind, and through your life. But if you have three, it's a little harder. If you have four, if you have five, if you have many more, it's even harder. I did a study on diabetes in primary care in Kenya, and I found that those who are diagnosed with diabetes compared to those seeking primary care without diabetes had 12 stressors compared to about 5 stressors. So the people who actually had diabetes were carrying a lot more distress in their life. So that might have been, you know, not having someone to rely on financially, not having, you know, having experienced violence or not feeling safe or experiencing other types of food insecurity. Those are the kind of stresses we were looking at in that study. But it's a good example of people, you know, if we think about diabetes, what hemoglobin A1C is, which is a long-term diagnostic of diabetes, it's a stress hormone. So I think about diabetes as a measure and reflection of stress itself. But what the thresholds narrative does is it brings together this theory of weathering and this theory of allostatic load or exosomes in biology, which all argue that the more layers of distress you have in the body, the more dysregulated your body will be. And that makes a lot of sense that people, and so one of my theories for long COVID or these unverifiable conditions in general is you're already carrying a lot of dysregulation in the body from possibly trauma, from, you know, unrectified conditions, from maybe biological vulnerability, maybe even environmental exposures. And you carry these conditions in the body, and then the virus, long COVID virus, tips you over the edge. You go over the threshold and your body goes into dysregulation. So it's not that you just randomly get an infection and your body dysregulates. It's that you have all of these things that you carry and it just gets to be too much. And, you know, it tips over into this place of dysregulation. So what are the things that can help you get well? There's not a magic bullet to, you know, overcome long COVID. And because it's this theory of thresholds that everyone has their own journey and their own thresholds of layering of distress, it's not going to be an easy one-size-fits-all solution. Rather, it needs to be very individualized, and people need a lot of attention. And so long COVID clinics themselves have to pay attention to the unique particularity of people's experiences.
Medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall is my guest. We're discussing Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. So you're describing a kind of understanding of these chronic conditions, these post-viral conditions by and large, as being the result of a threshold so that people are going to be affected differently by any particular virus depending on their life circumstances or underlying problems in the body, their environmental exposures, and so on. To what degree are people in the medical profession trained to be looking at patients in such a way? You know, when they get someone who comes in, their blood tests show nothing. They can't verify they have an illness, but the person is clearly suffering. What in the medical training of the sort of doctors who someone's likely to encounter equips them or doesn't for trying to get to the bottom of what's afflicting that person?
Medical school is a lot. It's incredibly busy, and there's so much you have to learn. One of the things that you don't get a lot of training in is public health. Another is complex chronic conditions. There isn't, in many medical school curriculums, there's absolutely maybe one lecture, but very limited training on understanding the complexities of a complex chronic condition at all. So many clinicians come to see these conditions, and they're, first of all, they're strapped for time because of our medical system. Doesn't allow for long extended visits because we're profit driven. But also patients may feel uncomfortable because there's not a clear diagnostic and they're unsure how to diagnose someone with long COVID. And a lot of clinicians aren't really sure if it's even real. That is, you know, everyone I interviewed, I did over 150 interviews for my book, Invisible Illness. And nearly every single patient I interviewed said at least one physician told them that it wasn't real. Now, many clinicians I have spoken to, and so many of my friends and colleagues or people who I've engaged with in the long COVID community take it very, very seriously. However, without training and a deep understanding, many clinicians will defer a patient to someone who they think has more experience or will suggest that the patient see someone else or maybe do other tests because they don't think it's that condition. So patients feel really vulnerable and dismissed, in part because clinicians aren't really sure what to do. So it's this catch-22, and I think on both sides, there's extraordinary frustration because we just people don't have the training, we don't have the social understanding, and in some ways, in so many instances, many patients have done leagues more research than the clinician they're speaking to. So they have this depth of knowledge, but because of their depth of knowledge comes from, you know, to be honest, Reddit or Facebook conversations or their own research into, you know, scholarly work or on PubMed, you know, really digging deep into scientific research that focuses on this, they may come to a clinical interaction and know much more than the clinician, but they don't know how to deliver it in a way that the clinician is going to engage with. So there's like a depth of communication barrier between the clinician and the patient. So that communication barrier creates, you know, people on both sides to put up walls. So having a long COVID clinic where people are, you know, have time to really explain what they know of themselves and also have clinicians who are really aware of and ready to care for them is just absolutely crucial. I have this woman, Tam, I already mentioned, who I talk about in the book, experienced so much trauma. She had disordered eating. She had this deep and prolonged endometriosis that for years was dismissed. Finally, she had a diagnosis and she's had so many different treatments throughout the years. And, you know, endometriosis is a really good example of a condition that is really hard to verify. And women so often are dismissed despite having extraordinary pain. How you can live with that and also go to a new clinician and explain something that is so unverifiable and get care either for your endometriosis or an emergent condition. For the mast cell condition that actually Tam had, this has actually compounded other allergies and her endometriosis to create a really, really difficult, very unique kind of unicorn condition that she has to explain whenever she goes to a clinician. She has to explain, she has to say, you know, my health is kind of weird and let me walk you through my journey. And it is exhausting to do that, especially when a condition's like, oh, she's just making this up. Because in many cases, women who experience conditions that are unverifiable, clinicians will write in their chart functional neurological disorder. Now, functional neurological disorder can be a real thing where, you know, they say, you know, you are feeling a deep pain and suffering, but it's a function of a psychological function. But in many cases of the people I have interviewed, they have a deep physical dysfunction that is actually causing their pain. So dismissing their pain as largely psychological is really upsetting and demoralizing. So this is kind of, you know, where the rubber hits the road in clinical medicine, I think.
In some ways, the poster child for the ways that the medical establishment has, and the public more broadly, has viewed post-viral conditions and invisible chronic illness, illnesses that someone is absolutely aware that they have but can't be measured, say, through a blood test, is ME/CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, which, you know, used to be referred to as the yuppie flu and was meant to be an affliction of upper middle class white women. Can you tell us how it was first conceived of?
Yeah, ME/CFS has been around. It's had lots of different names, and the name is still contested, and many patients don't like the name. But there were several outbreaks throughout the 1900s where there was a certain outbreak, and then people would have this chronic, unverifiable, unexplainable condition that very much looks like long COVID. And, you know, these little pockets of exposure were happening all over the world. And in many ways, they also reflected how people after the great influenza had these chronic experiences. And, you know, we don't have as much documentation in the Global South of how the great influenza caused a condition like long COVID or long flu. But we do have some instances. So there's a few historical, you know, this was also during World War I. So in so many times, a great influenza becomes a footnote in history, despite the fact that it was so extraordinary. For example, there's this really interesting piece on the famine of the corns, which was in Tanzania, where there was this infection, you know, some drivers were driving long distances, truck drivers who stopped and they infected the community. And people had the great influenza. It went all the way to this rural community. And people were so fatigued and disabled, they couldn't actually harvest their corn. So there was a famine. And, you know, these kinds of documentations are not as wide, but we know that they exist. So we know that long COVID or long flu or, you know, prolonged conditions are very common all around the world with all people, even if they're not as visible or as widely documented. Despite this kind of global relevance and recognition, the condition of chronic fatigue syndrome specifically, which is a part of myalgic encephalomyelitis, is very much constructed through a U.S. construct of biomedicine. And I think it's important to think about how in the United States we create and interpret certain illnesses. So chronic fatigue syndrome is often attributed to this one infection in Nevada where there was a infection in a ski community, like a resort community, and a number of middle-income, upper-income white individuals who were vacationing or resided in that community were infected. And because of this infection, these two clinicians working there, you know, called the Epidemic Intelligence Surveillance, which is EIS, is a incredible CDC training program for that was actually started by some of the folks who designed and implemented the global smallpox eradication campaign, which is the only disease ever to be eradicated. So they called EIS officers to come and investigate this infection. And just to note that EIS is under threat currently due to the dismantling of the CDC. But the EIS program has forever been a really important part of dealing with disease outbreaks and responding to the extraordinary threats that infections can bring to communities. And this was one of those threats. So there were over 200 people who had these post-viral conditions. And so these two EIS officers who were rather young were at the CDC, and many people were laughing and like, oh, this is the yuppie flu. You know, this isn't a real condition. It's, you know, so, you know, don't take it that seriously. Well, they got there and they saw a lot of people were disabled and, you know, severely so. And they did a study and, you know, they wanted to be really particular. So they kept narrowing it. So they had over 200 people who were experiencing these conditions. But what they found is that it was hard to narrow people down. So they excluded anyone who had other comorbidities, which if you think about long COVID or you think about a long flu or a complicated post-viral condition, people very rarely have just one condition. So they narrowed it down to about 15 candidates who are all upper-class white women. All of these upper-class white women who had no other comorbidities, and they just had this disabling infection that caused them to experience malaise or fatigue. And so they ended up categorizing this condition, this illness experience that affected over 200 people by this very narrow group of women. And there was a working group that, you know, kind of collaborated around this of nearly all white men who came together and decided to call this chronic fatigue syndrome. And since that time, you know, Anthony Komaroff, one of the physicians who was involved in the working group from the CDC, really found that patients were quite upset about this definition and really contested it. And, you know, he and others went and did a reinvestigation of everyone who was infected, and they found they had much more robust and inclusive conclusions. But for a long time, this early working group had a profound impact on how people who had post-viral conditions that were unverifiable were perceived as kind of fakes and not really sick in medicine. And I think that stigma and that kind of narrative has profoundly impacted medical education and how many clinicians perceive and understand this condition. Although I would argue that the profound impact of COVID has shifted a lot of people's views and really educated people who weren't as familiar with post-viral conditions, who are clinicians and not clinicians, in the general public to understand what this condition is and what it does.
Tell us about Lyme disease. Lyme disease being borne by ticks, a virus often coupled with other viruses borne by ticks. How has the medical establishment dealt with the possibility of someone being infected with Lyme? And tell us the story of that and whether it changed, shifted at all over time.
Well, the real expert on Lyme is in the anthropological community is Abigail Dumas. She wrote this beautiful book, Divided Bodies, which I mentioned earlier. I mentioned Lyme a bit earlier because the chapter on Lyme in this book, which is really kind of another kind of extension of the chronic fatigue syndrome story, the challenge with Lyme is that defining and including Lyme as a real condition has been largely contested in medicine. And many clinicians who actually treat Lyme have to do so off the book so they can't take insurance. Otherwise, some people have been fearful that if they diagnose Lyme, that they will lose their medical license. And partly this is because the length and extraordinary experience of getting care for Lyme is no easy matter, and it's extended and not always successful. So the contention within clinicians who, really advocate for diagnosing and understanding chronic Lyme, even if it doesn't have this telltale symptom of, a bullseye mark or having a verifiable acute Lyme infection. The diagnostic of chronic Lyme is something that clinicians do not agree with. And, in Abigail's book, she writes about how there are more conventional views in medicine and then more Lyme literate views. And these camps, at least in the generation previous, are quite contentious. Although this is changing pretty profoundly in this new generation of clinicians, especially the generation of clinicians who worked through the COVID pandemic and who have cared for people with these complex chronic conditions and are recognizing how profound these infections live on in the body. So that culture is shifting, but Lyme has for so long been this challenge, not only for patients. Invisible Kingdom by Megan O'Rourke is a beautiful story of chronic Lyme, and it's so difficult and heartbreaking. But that is such a wonderful book that tells the story of chronic Lyme. But what is so challenging about chronic Lyme is this tension in the medical community about those who really want to take it seriously and get to the bottom of the multiple layers of suffering that bring someone to experience Lyme, and those who just kind of want to dismiss it.
Many people who have post-viral chronic illnesses struggle with fatigue and also with brain fog. And of course, both of these are hard for someone in the medical profession anyway, to measure, at least in terms of, a marker in the blood. But obviously, talking to the patients, they certainly could measure those things. But do you think the kind of cloudy nature of defining something like brain fog or fatigue adds to the trickiness in people getting sufficient medical both diagnosis and care?
Yeah, I wrote about this in Scientific American because the construct of brain fog is so difficult, in part because, and I initially called this piece brain fog multiple because I had this wonderful student who became really, really disabled from long COVID. He's thankfully recovered now and in medical school, but he had such intense memory issues that he couldn't remember anything beyond 10-minute intervals. And I was thinking about my own brain fog, especially after, that brain fog you have after having a child or going through a trauma that you experience where, you're having trouble focusing, but it's more like you're walking in a daze. Now, that is common among people with long COVID. But his brain fog, which was still called brain fog, was more memory issues. He couldn't remember things in 10-minute intervals. He would also have intense sensitivities to light. He couldn't remember long-term things as well, and he felt like he couldn't really communicate in the world as he once did. So he had to change his whole way of dealing with his mind. And this is so common. But brain fog is not one thing. It is multiple experiences and different levels. I mean, and brain fog is the brain fog for some, especially the elderly who've gotten long COVID, has led to dementia. And we know infections for a long time have led and increased risks of dementia long term. So, you know, when we think about brain fog and we use that term, it's really complicated because it's so different for people. And it can be so extraordinary and also be linked to cognitive decline for some. And in other cases, it might just be more of a brain fatigue or, you know, more of a attention deficit ability or inability to kind of have executive functioning to get yourself organized. Now, these are very different afflictions. And I think, again, it's not actually that there's a problem that people have different conditions. It's a problem of naming. You know, it's a problem of society identifying something as brain fog when it's extraordinarily different based on people's experience. Now, the issue of fatigue, you know, and exhaustion, you know, fatigue and exhaustion are characteristic of chronic illness in general. They are, you know, part of aging. They are, you know, lived in such different ways in different people's bodies. And I think that's another way of thinking about what is fatigue itself, especially in relation to ME/CFS. So one of the ways in which people distinguish ME/CFS and long COVID is this condition called post-exertional malaise. Now, post-exertional malaise is the experience of what I mentioned earlier, that someone might take a shower or walk up the stairs or cook a meal. And from doing these routine tasks, they may feel absolutely exhausted. Now, in the patient community, often, and in the disability community more generally, people use this excellent framework of spoons, so spoon theory. Spoon theory was created by a woman who had lupus, an autoimmune disease. Then she created this idea. She's like, okay, I've got 12 spoons. If I'm going to take a shower, that's one spoon. If I'm going to, you know, make a meal, that's another spoon. If I'm going to go give a lecture, that's four spoons. You know, I'm already at six spoons. If I'm going to drive my car, that's two more spoons. The exertion that you need and the ability to do certain things has to be, you know, carefully negotiated every single day. And people who have extraordinary fatigue are constantly thinking about what kind of energy they have. I spoke to one woman who was a professor who has ME/CFS. She explained to me, you know, I'm an ambulatory wheelchair user, which is very common. And this is actually a struggle for people who are, you know, able-bodied, but they have extraordinary fatigue. And so they use a wheelchair to get around. They can get up and stand and move from it. But because fatigue disables them from being able to live their life and do other things, their wheelchair is an extraordinary tool to conserve their energy for the things they want to use. So fatigue itself, some people have extraordinarily severe disabling fatigue from doing the, you know, the most routine mundane tasks. And others are able, they have, you know, less disabling fatigue, but still really need to manage their spoons throughout the day and think about how they can engage the world in a new way because of their energy limitations.
I'm speaking with medical anthropologist Emily Mendenhall. We're discussing Invisible Illness, her book, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. So Emily, we've been talking about the ways the medical establishment is often befuddled by people with invisible chronic illnesses, the challenges that patients have to negotiate the medical world, this kind of stigma that's attached to a lot of these illnesses as afflictions of women. I wanted to ask you about race and how that shapes how patients are treated, particularly with these kinds of illnesses that are not immediately apparent to the eye of the clinician.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, in part because people come into the clinic with so many different social identities. Race, disability, gender, sexuality, nationality, health insurance class. I think race plays a profound impact, especially in American racism. Medical racism is a really big problem. And we know the maternal mortality data that shows that Black women are often not believed that they're suffering or that they're in pain during childbirth is pretty closely related to the high rates of maternal mortality. And this, of course, plays out in all sorts of diagnostics and medical experiences of believing, not but being believed that they're in pain or not believing that they have this complex chronic condition. And so the dismissiveness is profound. And, so many women I spoke to, specifically women of all different racial and ethnic identities, but particularly Black women I spoke with, discussed how they had to really advocate for themselves. And one of the ways in which people described being able to advocate for themselves is by paying. And of course, this is people who have means, paying for a health advocate. So if you have a complex chronic condition and you aren't being taken seriously, you really have to hire a health advocate to come in and help you negotiate with a clinician. One of the really interesting things, I spoke with JD Davids, who I talk about in the book, who's an incredible writer and activist, who he worked with ACT UP in the 90s and has from the kind of activist training with ACT UP, which is the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, which was founded at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. From that activist training, was able to bring that to the ME/CFS community and then the long COVID community, because in those early days of the AIDS pandemic, they would actually write an entire page of how you interact with your clinician and how you advocate for yourself and what tests you need to get to make sure that your needs are cared for. Because so many clinicians didn't understand the condition and weren't as familiar with caring for people with these conditions, which of course is so common now. And in part because ME/CFS has been associated for so long with kind of middle class, upper class white women, people of color for so long have gone in and had really similar symptoms and have just been completely dismissed. So having a health advocate come in with you to the clinic is crucial to be recognized and understood as someone who's having these complex chronic conditions, in part so you can really begin to get care and treatment.
Emily, I'd like to end by asking you about how people have organized around long COVID and what the connections of that kind of organization has to, you mentioned earlier generations of people organizing around HIV/AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome. How have people who have organized around long COVID connected their struggles or been directly connected to the disability justice movement?
Ryan Pryor, in his book on long COVID activism, argued that, quoting a scientist at Yale who said that the women who organized around long COVID in the earliest days of the long COVID experience were much like the HIV/AIDS activists of the early 1980s, like Larry Kramer and other AIDS activists that really transformed the condition. And in so many ways, the organization of long COVID activism is built on this depth of activism of racial ju for racial justice, for disability justice, and for health activism, health justice. Because this woman, Fiona Lowenstein, and others associated with body politic, health and wellness community were infected with long COVID in the earliest days. They organized a WhatsApp group so they would kind of share with people in their community about their conditions and what they're experiencing. And this blew up. I mean, thousands of people from around the world joined this group. Then they moved it to Slack and they kind of disaggregated their groups. And Fiona was writing in the New York Times about her experience, and people were starting to see that others were really experiencing similar things. So this organization was, and the activists who planted the seeds for the long COVID activism were deeply embedded in other lineages of activism, especially activists like ME Action, and several other health activist groups came together to rise up with the long COVID activists and recognize And actually, many disability activists, even before the, you know, long COVID was recognized in like January of 2020, were saying, this is going to be extraordinary burden on our community. We need to start organizing now. So how the activism has escalated has actually transformed in different ways. So there's a lot of pockets of Facebook group. There's a lot of virtual support, a lot of virtual support and one-on-one supporting communities that have emerged kind of organically. But there's also the patient-led research collaborative, which is really incredible, PLRC, that ended up kind of weaving off of this Slack group. They were called Data Nerds, but they organized this patient-led research collaborative where they were actually doing research on themselves, and they've published in variations of The Lancet and elsewhere this really high-level analysis of the first long COVID symptoms. So they've really led the charge to recognize what long COVID is and how to study it and what it does. And by doing that, they've taken control of the story and the narrative. Even long COVID was a term that was tweeted by a patient. She was also an archaeologist and scholar who was living, she was from Lombardy, Italy, and she was there at the time, Elisa Perego, and she identified long COVID in a tweet, and it was retweeted so many times the medical community couldn't even, they use other terms for it, but this kind of social category has been so profound that it has been taken on by, you know, people across the world. So the activism around long COVID has been so interesting to follow and fascinating to see the leadership and collective reckoning of this condition. And it's been a really important moment for health activism, I think.
Emily Mendenhall, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
Emily Mendenhall is professor at Georgetown University. She's the author of Invisible Illness, A History from Hysteria to Long COVID. Her other books include Unmasked. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.